833-0850. Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In October of 1871, several square miles of Chicago were destroyed by a fire. And in many ways, that fire helped to create the city of Chicago that we know today. It is probably the most famous, most well-known of all of the great urban fires in American history, but it's certainly not the only one. This morning, we'll be talking about a few of them with historian Peter Hoffer. He's a distinguished research professor of history at the University of Georgia. And in a new book titled Seven Fires, The Urban Infernos That Reshaped America, he makes the argument that all of these fires taken together have not only reshaped the cities where they lived, but in many ways shaped the course of American history. Just to read a couple lines from his introduction to get us started, he says that what he's trying to do in this book is ask how we as people and as a nation prepare for our city fires and sometimes negligently increase the risk of them, how we fight them and sometimes lose, how we are transfixed by the raw spectacle of conflagrations and yet summon the courage to combat them. It probes how we make sense of urban fires and rebuild after them. The book has just recently been published. Public Affairs is the publisher on the book. You certainly can find it in a bookstore near you. And questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, be involved in the conversation, the number is 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, so that means if it would be long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or you could be listening on the Internet in the United States and use the toll-free, again, 800-222-9455. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We just ask people who call in to try and be brief with their comments so we can keep things moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Hoffer, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
The fires, just maybe quickly here, I will list them, the ones that you talk about. The first is a fire that occurred in Boston, colonial Boston, so that was 1760, Pittsburgh, 1845, Chicago, 1871, Baltimore, 1904, Detroit, 1967, Oakland Hills, 1991, and you finish up with the fires that were the result of the attacks of 9/11 in New York. And I know people right off might say, well, somehow that doesn't fit, but what you're suggesting people do as far as 9/11 is concerned is for a second set aside the cause and just use that as a case study of a high-rise fire, which is certainly an important problem in modern American cities. Now, having said that, was it in fact 9/11 that actually started you thinking about this?
Actually, no, it wasn't. Huh. It was a wonderful exhibit at the Chicago Historical Society on the Great Fire of Chicago many years ago. Huh. And the thing that every historian wants to do, whether they admit it or not, is go back to the past, to live for a few moments or even a lifetime in a time long ago. But looking at that fire, I decided that was not a particular moment when I wanted to visit Chicago. Still, it's an amazing story, and it's a story that's been told before, but never, I thought, in the context of these other city fires. So it was Chicago that started it.
Huh. Well, you certainly, in the way that you write about fire, about what firefighters experience, about these fires, they're certainly very vivid. And I think for us now, if it's difficult to imagine what it would be like to experience a fire on this scale, even if one has seen, maybe you've seen a big fire, and that's frightening and impressive, but to then imagine what it would be like to see one of these great urban fires where we're talking about many square miles being on fire, it's very difficult to imagine what that would be like.
Well, I hope that no one has to experience that. But the closest thing, I think, is you watch the films of the Tokyo firestorms or the London Blitz. You get some idea of the power of fire in a city, because all cities are giant tinderboxes. In a way, they have to be, because they need fire to exist. They're built around fire, around forges and mills and bakeries and whatever, but they also are full of combustible materials. So a city is always ripe for fire. What I tried to do with these fires is walk the fire course and try to imagine what it was like. I mean, I'd read the newspaper accounts, I'd read the archival accounts, the firsthand eyewitness accounts. I've been close to some nasty fires, never fought them, but watched the men who did, the men and women who did, and got some appreciation that way. But it really is hard in words, even words and pictures, to convey the immediate experience of a giant fire.
Yeah. Maybe people will recall just recently having seen some of the dramatic footage of this fire that took place in New York City, the building that burned. This is the building that apparently the man who owned the building is the suspect. He was involved in a difficult divorce proceedings and is alleged to have set the fire himself. And I remember seeing that, and here there was a remarkable conflagration going on with this house burning. There were two other buildings right on either side of it.
Yes.
And you would think that there might have been a time when something like that could have touched off a much, much bigger fire, but we didn't see big chunk of New York burning down as a result. So that would have to suggest that something, whether it's about our technology of fighting fires, maybe it has something to do with the way buildings are constructed, would suggest that the kind of big urban fires that we have seen in the past, like the Chicago fire, for example, are unlikely to occur today in a big industrial, in a Western industrial city.
Well, that's what folks thought after the Chicago fire, when Root and Burnham and Louis Sullivan and others started to build fireproof buildings using steel and concrete and fireproof tile. And then, of course, you have the great Baltimore fire of 1904, when seven buildings that these guys built in Baltimore using what they had learned from the Chicago fire all were gutted by fire. So the more we learn about fireproofing, the more we fireproof our buildings like the Twin Towers, the more we fool ourselves. You cannot prevent fire. But the fire in New York, the reason why that didn't catch on to the buildings next door is because it was a gas explosion. Mm-hmm. And what the explosion did is it consumed a lot of the combustible material. So in a way, the immediateness of the devastation contained the fire. So they were lucky. The poor fellow who, the doctor who perhaps decided to take the building and his own life in the same stroke, because he used the gas, that may have saved the buildings next door. Although the explosion blew out the windows, and when you blow out windows, you invite fire into the building.
Mm. I want to have you talk a little bit about some of these fires, particularly those that will be less well known, starting with this fire in 1760 in Boston. Here we have a case where you would think that this is a city that would be quite susceptible to fire, in part because all the buildings were made out of wood, or most of them would have been made out of wood, and the technology of firefighting at the time wouldn't be what it was that we had today. Talk a little bit about the Boston Fire of 1760.
Well, I mean, Boston was the city was a natural fire course. The city fathers kept passing laws that required tile roofs and all sorts of other means of preventing fire. And the landlords kept, as they do today, circumventing these rules because they were very expensive and it was easier to rebuild than it was to fireproof. But the remarkable thing about this fire in 1760 is that it not only guts a central part of Boston, but when Bostonians turn to the crown and ask for aid, they're cold-shouldered. And that flows into larger and even swifter currents of protest. So that it turns out that the people who become the leaders of that protest, the leaders of the Sons of Liberty, were in fact either fire wardens or firemen. They learned how to organize, they learned how to mobilize, they learned how to set fires and how to put them out as firemen, and their experience came from the 1760 fire.
That's an interesting aspect of this fire that truly, if you look at the subtitle of the book about how these fires reshaped America, if indeed you can make the argument that there's that fire and then outrage by the people of Boston about the failure of the British government to do anything to offer any kind of help for their recovery, if that was funneled into ultimately the American Revolution, then indeed you can make the argument this fire and its aftermath had a very important role in shaping America.
Well, your suspicions rise when you notice that the two new fire wardens are John Hancock and Sam Adams. And that the leader of the South Boston mob, who leads the stamp tax protests in the street, Ebenezer McIntosh, is in fact a leading fireman. Of course, the fire is not the cause of the American Revolution. But since Boston is the cockpit of the revolution and these connections are there, the fire becomes a very, very important igniter or catalyst of protest.
Hmm. One of the remarkable things I think about this particular fire is that even though it was very destructive, no one died.
Well, it did start in the middle of the night, probably in a tavern. But city fires in general move fairly slowly. The fire moves driven by the wind, but stops to consume buildings. It doesn't move the 30 or 40 miles an hour that a canyon fire moves in the West. Some of these horrific fires in California can move very, very fast. So people have a chance, particularly if the highest building is only three stories, to get out of the building and to flee. What's more, Boston is surrounded by water. There are places to go. It's true of Pittsburgh as well, that only two people died or documented as dying in that fire. Because it's low rise and you have a chance to flee, and there are places where you can flee. In a fire like Chicago, where you begin to get buildings that are much bigger, that are six and seven and eight stories, densely packed together, and where you have only a few routes like Randolph out of the loop, when you have a fast-moving fire as you did, wind-driven fire as you did, then it's hard for people to outrun it. And that's when you have a lot of people who die. Over 300 died, and probably twice that many. The estimates for the number of people who die depend upon people who have some identity in the city. And there are always many, many people in the city, a colonial city or an industrial city, who really don't have a sort of documented identity. When they perish, as they did by the thousands, for example, even in 9/11, we still haven't identified all of those people.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again very quickly the guest for this hour, Peter Hoffer. He's professor of history at the University of Georgia and is author of the book Seven Fires. That book looks at seven big urban fires, among them the Chicago Fire of 1871, and talks about how not only did they shape the future of those cities, but there are some ways in which you could argue that the fires and their aftermath shaped the country. And that is what the subtitle of the book suggests. Published by Public Affairs, in the bookstore now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. The next fire that you talk about is Pittsburgh, 1845. And here is you open this section on the book. You write, "The people of Boston feared fire. The founders of Pittsburgh welcomed it." And you talked about how you have to have fire in a city. And at this time, certainly, fires would have been used for heating, for cooking, for lighting. But here, this was a place in Pittsburgh where right next to each other, you had people living and you had industry that used fire. And no doubt people in Pittsburgh thought that they were the master of the fire, and the fire taught them something different.
It was the Birmingham of America. It was covered with soot from soft burning coal. It's almost like a patina all over the city that light a match and start a fire. And they had many small fires. But the fire of April 1845 is the biggest, and it guts central Pittsburgh. And it's because everyone sort of accepted the risks of those kinds of fires, iron foundries and mills and all the things that Pittsburgh manufactured for the West. Pittsburgh was the great industrial port and manufacturing center for the American West.
Here you would have thought that the people would have been well aware of the risk and would have whatever the state of the art of firefighting was at the time, just what would that have been?
Well, you need, first of all, you need personnel. Well, they had volunteer fire companies. And these were more social organizations than they were professional organizations. Sometimes the firefighters would fight with one another on the way to the fire. They were as much drinking clubs as they were firefighting organizations. Then you need water. And Pittsburgh had a rudimentary system with water pipes and water pumps and hydrants. But they found on that day that they didn't have enough water pressure to fight the fire. Then you need a certain amount of luck, and that it involves the wind. If it's a quiet day, then you can pretty much contain a fire. If it's a windy day, then you can't. And that was certainly true of Pittsburgh. The wind had come up, and the fire, which had started when a washerwoman let a fire under an outdoor pot of water get out of hand, and the cinders were carried by the wind to a shed. And then as the shed caught fire, the wind happened to pick up and carried it across the street. And what happens is in Pittsburgh and later in Chicago, the danger spot is the roof. The roofs are places to which the fire, the cinders are carried by the wind, and the roof catches fire. And then there's no way that the firefighters can keep up with the fire because it's jumping over them from rooftop to rooftop. So while they're following it like infantry, it's moving like cavalry, rushing ahead of them, and sometimes even trapping them behind it, which is something that no firefighter wants to happen. And that's what happened in Pittsburgh. The fire raced from the center of the city all the way down to the Monongahela River, started the warehouses on the riverside on fire, burned the bridges, was burning the steamboats and the other smaller boats. They had to be launched into the river if they were to be saved.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that, starting with someone listening in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Wipeout of the colored district in Kansas around the time of the Civil War include a burnout? Just a question.
Well, is that something you can answer, Professor Hopper?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know this, that every time there's a race riot, Tulsa, East St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, there are fires. And the fires always seem to find the poorer districts. It may be in San Francisco, it may be Chinatown. In Kansas City or in Chicago or Detroit, it will be African-American ghettos or other poorer areas. Mm-hmm. Why this is so, it's in part it's because the housing is more fire-prone.
Yeah. That raises another question. Whatever military endeavors I've come across, it seems that the massive destruction of an area seemed to be a planned redevelopment of a something like Germany, Japan, what have you. Is there any sense in saying that that's a possibility?
Let me take it back to the American Civil War. One of the ways in which Americans become very acquainted with urban fire is looking at pictures of what happens to Richmond, for example, or to Atlanta, or to Columbia, South Carolina, as they're gutted by fire. Fire is a tool that a conquering army or an invading army uses to destabilize local populations, to destroy infrastructure, to destroy food supplies and ammunition. So in that sense, yes, armies set fires. Of course, in World War II, it's air forces that set fires. And again, the point is that fire is so devastating to the ordinary patterns of life in areas of dense population that it's a perfect weapon. Whether this is meant as a form of reconstruction, I don't think so.
All right, let's talk with someone else. We have someone calling from Hoopston. They're on a cell phone, so we'll go there. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Another interesting program. Just two quick comments, and then I'll go ahead and ring off and let your guest comment. There was a program not too long ago about the fire in Boston, and I apologize ahead of time if you've already covered this, but it said at that point, and I think it was 1850s or 1860s, they turned a corner. They stopped using explosives to fight urban fires, in other words, blowing up blocks in front of the fire. Some rationale they were using that, and then they stopped using that because they found it was counterproductive. And also the other comment was at the time of the Chicago fire, if I understand this correctly, this is not an urban fire, but there was this huge fire in Wisconsin that got very, very little coverage, obviously because it was happening at the same time as the Chicago fire. And just want to know if you could comment on that, and I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, very interesting comment. First of all, the 1872 Boston fire gutted about as much of Boston in the roughly the same place, although there had been a lot more landfill, as the 1760 fire. And again, the culprit there was the mansard roofs. You had these wonderful commercial blocks in this, French style with these lovely mansard roofs. And a mansard roof is basically this oxygen container covered with a flammable top. So when sparks hit it, it almost explodes. What they tried to do in Boston was they tried to save the rest of the city by blowing up blocks. It is not true that they stopped doing that after the 1872 fire in Boston, even though, in fact, it proved useless in Boston. They tried that in 1904 in Baltimore, and it had the same effect. All that it did is it carried a windstorm of burning debris even farther down the wind, jumping over the dynamiters and the firefighters. So blowing up blocks has never proved to work. It's a last resort, and it doesn't work. Now, the second comment was about the firestorm in Peshtigo, which was a Wisconsin timbering community up the lake from Chicago. That summer and fall, the land was so dried, no rain, so hot, so windy, that the whole region had become a fire course, and there were fires all over. In fact, the lake, Lake Michigan, was so covered with smoke that the ships had to use their foghorns to warn one another that they were there. You couldn't see. What happened in Peshtigo is that peat fires were sucked up into the air, probably by a tornado, raced over the town, killing more by suffocation, sucking the air, burning up all the oxygen, sucking the air out and racing over, and perhaps as many as 2,500 or even 3,000 farmers and their families were killed in the space of about an hour and a half. So it is the worst single land fire disaster in American history. And there are a couple of good books on it.
I think it is interesting, though, as the caller says, that I'm sure people in Wisconsin remember it. Maybe some people in the Midwest will. But this actually happened at the same day as the Chicago fire,
yes.
October 8, 1871, and
right.
Yet now everybody know, or almost everybody will have at least heard of the Chicago fire, but the Peshtigo fire, people in the Midwest maybe will have heard of it. People in Wisconsin will have heard of it, but it's not well known today.
Well, I don't mean to be cynical, but the Chicago fire, in modern terms, is a $3 billion plus fire. The terrible loss in Peshtigo and the surrounding area was a loss in human life. But then, I mean, many of these people were immigrants. They had, some of them actually had literally just gotten off the boat, finding their way into the town to work in the timber mills or to start farming. The value of the land and the value of their lives was so small compared to the value of Chicago's real estate that they have not gained the attention that they deserve that they should get.
We are at our midpoint already in this hour of Focus. Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Peter Hoffer. He's Distinguished Research Professor of History at the University of Georgia and is author of a recently published book, Seven Fires, The Urban Infernos That Reshaped America. It's published by Public Affairs. And as he explains, it is indeed an account of seven major city fires. Fires that occurred in Boston, 1760, Pittsburgh, 1845, Chicago, 1871, Baltimore, 1904, Detroit, 1967, Oakland Hills in California in October of 1991, and then the fires that resulted from the attacks at the World Trade Center in New York City in September 11, 2001, and looks at the ways not only did that shape life in those cities afterward, but that that indeed had a larger effect on America. The book's out in the bookstore. You can go and look at it. And questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Yeah, I had a, and not particularly comment on that, but unique experience in my last 2 years of undergraduate. I was working my way through school, and I actually lived in the fire department and was a fireman, but that's not the main. I just remember historically, and I'd like you to comment on it, that actually that sometimes the two different fire groups would get there to fire, and they'd actually end up in a fight because it was the first one there or something or other. I don't know what year that was. But the other one is that the technology, when we go back to then, a lot of it was based on, you know, sort of volume, you know, in terms of water, with the increase in pressure where you could break, you know, the water break up high pressure would actually cool down a fire. So maybe just a comment, you know, comparison to then and today.
All right. Well, Professor Hoffer, can you do that?
Well, I think if you got one of your good Seagrave pumpers out there to the O'Leary Bond, and you hooked up the supply lines to your pumper, and you got three or four good hand lines, and you got the water pressure that you have today, you would have put out that fire, and you would have put out the fire in the surrounding sheds. So your caller is absolutely right. The technology has changed tremendously in terms of the availability of water, in terms of the water pressure coming out of the hydrants, in terms of the water pressure that the fire engines, the pumpers, can deliver. The Chicago Fire Force, by that time, was a professional force. And the difference between the amateurs, the volunteer firemen, and the professional force is tremendous, a huge difference. The amateurs express a kind of 19th century masculine valor, fueled sometimes by alcohol, by pride, and so on. So the companies compete with one another. The professional fire companies cooperate with one another. They are, I don't know how your caller would feel about this, but they really are paramilitary organizations. They have ranks. The officers work closely with the firefighters. Beside them, the commanders are there, too. Communications are electronic. They're vital, so that the whole unit works as a whole, at least ideally. And that skill, plus the technological skill that every firefighter has now and that every fire service has now, makes firefighting far more efficient. But the remarkable flip side of that, as your caller probably knows, is because firefighters now have the first mission as saving lives. That means that they go into fires. And this puts them much closer to danger than the volunteer fire company of the 19th century. So that fighting the Chicago fire, no firefighter lost his life in the course of fighting that fire. In the course of fighting the fires in 9/11, 343 senior officers, commanders, officers, and firefighters lost their lives because they went into those buildings to rescue people who had been injured by the blast, by the impact, and by the fire. So in a way, all of the increase in skill, the mastery of technology, which makes firefighting so much more efficient today, has also exposed firefighters to greater danger.
Hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about, or I'd like you to talk a little bit about what happened in Detroit in the summer in July of 1967, and the unrest that was going on there, the fires that resulted here. Again, it was very destructive. More than 2,000 buildings burned down. Why do you want to include that, and in what sense does that tell you something about how things have changed from, let us say, the fires that occurred in the 19th century to what happened here? Because indeed, one of the features of these fires that took place in 1967 was they were deliberately set, or at least many of them were deliberately set.
Yes, they were. Anyone who grew up as I did in the 1960s. I was young then, but I grew up in the 1960s, and you watched on television. Since I was in New York City, you sort of waited for the urban fires to come, whether it was Watts or Cleveland or Newark or Detroit or many other cities. They were burning. And they were burning because the people who lived in them were setting them on fire. And that was a phenomenon of American history that I thought I had to explain. There was no chapter that was harder for me to write. I mean, not in the sense of doing the research. The people in Detroit were wonderful in terms of opening archives to me and showing me the pictures, and I got to read the police logs and the fire logs and the internal reports and the memos and everything else. They were wonderful that way. But writing a story about a people who were so frustrated and who despaired so that the only recourse seemed to set fire to the stores that were in their neighborhood and even to their neighbors' homes, or at least to be indifferent to the spread of those fires. That was a heart-rending story to write. But it had to be written because that's another way in which fire became a part of the American urban history story. And I picked Detroit in part because Detroit is the one city that seems never to have recovered.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to Detroit now, you don't see the burned-out houses anymore, but the vacant lots are still there. And you drive down a splendid avenue like Woodward, and you see open spaces as though somehow the memorial is an absence of a memorial, or an absence perhaps of will to rebuild.
This must have presented an unusual challenge or an additional challenge to firefighters that not only were they trying to fight the fire, but there was a riot going on.
Yes, and people were shooting at them. The thing that struck me was this, as I read the firsthand accounts and the newspaper accounts and so on, was that many of the older residents, white and black, in the neighborhoods welcomed the firefighters. They knew that the firefighters, unlike the police force, were there to help them. They knew that they were a part of the community. Whenever there was a car accident, whenever someone was sick, the first person that you called the fire department, because you knew they would come. So the snipers and the rocks and the catcalls are not coming from the older folks. They're coming, as I found, I discovered, from the same people who were setting the fires, and that was the very young people, teenagers, who sort of had no attachment to the city and certainly no sense that the firefighters were there for them.
Hmm. The Oakland Hills firestorm, this was the fall of 1991, October 1991, makes an opportunity again to look at some of the ways that the way people live change. And I guess here it shows you some of the difficulties and the challenges when people decide they want to live closer in where nature is. Here it shows you some of the difficulties you get into when people go and decide they want to live in places where people previously hadn't. And one of the big differences between this perhaps and some of the other urban fires that you talk about is that historically it seemed that the poor people were the ones that were the most affected, no doubt because they were the ones that were living in housing that was most susceptible, or perhaps sections of the city that were most susceptible. Here we're talking about a place where the people who lived there were very wealthy, and there were expensive houses.
Oh, yes, it's true of all of coastal California. You go up to those hills, and you find houses that are now millions and millions of dollars. Then, in the early 90s, were hundreds of thousands of dollars. Many of them old houses, classic architecture, and so on. the poor folks live down in the floodplain in Oakland City proper. You go up into those hills, and those are beautiful old houses where the rich folks live. But it's a natural fire course. All of those hills, you get that frowned wind coming out of the east, hot and dry. And if you have a fire going, and that was they had not sufficiently overhauled a rubbish fire from the day before. You get those sparks going up into the air, and that wind carries them. And then you put in Monterey pine, which burns. I just snapped my fingers. You can't hear that.
I actually did hear that. Yes,
but it just burns. Everyone knows that. I mean, those pines, they just go up, and then the needles. I mean, they just carry the fire everywhere, and then you have hot burning flora that's been planted very close to these buildings. You have these wooden shingles that give the houses a wonderful old California look, but burn so easily. And man, that fire just roars down that hill. The problem was that the hill is cut by these gullies and switchbacks and so on, so that you get little isolated communities. And the entrance to and exit from these little isolated communities, these two-lane roads, that was particularly true of one housing development and an apartment complex about the middle of the hill, down the hill. And they just had these narrow access roads. And people jump in their cars and create an instant traffic jam trying to get out of these lovely, beautifully landscaped fire traps. And 25 people died simply trying to get out. I mean, you had to leave the car and flee on foot. And the fire is moving about as fast as you can run. So people who had cars stopped. They pulled people into the cars, people that they knew, people that they didn't know. Every car was full of people as it managed to go down Tunnel Road and get out of that neighborhood. But a lot of folks probably watched that. It was a Sunday, and a lot of people probably watched that because they were watching the San Francisco 49ers football game, and you could see across from Candlestick Park. The Oakland Hills are on the east side of San Francisco Bay, and you could see this pall of smoke as though the hills were being bombed.
Mm-hmm.
The San Francisco firefighters from all over the East Bay raced across. San Francisco sent about one-third of its entire firefighting force over the bridge to fight that fire. And the San Francisco firefighters and the Oakland firefighters and the firefighters from the East Bay Regional, they managed to stop it, but they were lucky because the wind died down in the evening.
Now, I imagine some people might quibble with this being included in the book with the other big urban fires that we talked about. They might say this is what we have here is it's a classic wildfire, and we wouldn't be talking about it, or at least in this same context, if people hadn't decided this is a place that they wanted to live and created these communities that were very susceptible. Is there some way in which this is more than just that and actually fits in to this larger frame where we're talking about classic urban fires like the Great Chicago Fire?
Well, actually, I would say the reverse. I would say the new urban fire is likely to be this kind of ground fire in a suburban area, which moves very swiftly through the suburban area. We're talking about areas now where the real estate values and the value of houses probably exceeds that in the city core itself. What's more, look at Phoenix. Look at Oklahoma City. It's happening again in California. These fires are the fires that menace some of the richest areas of our cities, as our cities sprawl into natural fire courses, and the fire comes out of the hills or through the canyons or over the plains, where the city shouldn't be. and that's where the city growth now is.
Yeah, and of course these fires, by their nature, are much more difficult to fight. The technique of fighting them is going to be different than fighting an urban fire. It's a completely different thing.
I mean, the technique of fighting an urban fire that we've learned over the years is heavy equipment. The guys get as close to the fire as they can. They're wearing protective gear. They're wearing what's called bunker gear now, which can sustain them for at least a few minutes in pretty hot fire. And they pour water on the fire, or they pour fire retardants on the fire. But that's because the fire is not moving fast. I mean, it's moving, but it's relatively stable. So as your troops can surround it and fight it hand to hand. These ground fires, like Oakland Hills and now like Los Angeles and so on, move so fast that you can't get your heavy equipment out of the way. So you're having to fight them with many of the methods that the Park Service uses to fight wildfires, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning, but you know the learning curve is steep.
About 10 minutes left in this hour of the show with our guest, Peter Hoffer, professor of history at University of Georgia. His book, again, Seven Fires, if you'd like to read it, published by Public Affairs, taking a look at seven urban fires, historic urban fires, throughout the course of American history, beginning with Boston 1760 and ending with the fires of 9/11 in New York City, talking about how it is those fires shape life in America. We have another caller here, and we'll talk with them. This is someone listening in Champaign, and line number one.
Could you say something about training fire departments to set ecological fires? Often in settings where the ecology is based on a fire burn, I think it's important that fire departments be able to start fires and preventative fires. And some of the suburbs of Chicago, they have changed their policies to putting out fires when they happened to burning, of being part of the burn policy when the ecology is such that every 3 years or 5 years it should be burned to prevent the disaster of buildings being burned down. Could you say something about the training that fire departments are receiving to start fires?
All right. Can you talk about that, Professor Hoffer?
I didn't hear the entire question. Training fire departments to deal with what kind of fires?
To initiate ecological fires. A lot of your housing is in fancy areas is on ecologically based, fire-based ecology.
Ah, okay.
We need fire departments that know how to burn, to create a fire at a sensible time.
Oh, you're talking about controlled burns. And
yes, yes.
Yeah, of course, you know, controlled burns have gotten sort of a bad name after Los Alamos, that terrible fire that was supposed to be a controlled burn and got out of hand in New Mexico. So we go back and forth about this. Now, you know that way back when, at the beginning of the 20th century, the Park Service and the federal government decided that they simply were not going to tolerate these natural burns. They were going to have a no-fire policy, a massive output of energy and material and training of how to contain wildfires and forest fires. Then they sort of developed the idea much later on that fires were natural. And that fire, if you didn't have a burn-off periodically of the underbrush that had accumulated over the years, then you got horrific fires. Then you got catastrophic fires, crown fires that went up into the tops of these trees and burned hundreds of thousands of acres. So they developed this concept of the controlled burn. I can tell you that the New York City Fire Department of New York, does have a program. They do have units that are trained. They do have equipment that is designed to do preventive burning, to burn off areas so that fires cannot progress, in effect creating a burned-over zone to contain a fire. But the fact is, you and I both know that you get a wind that's blowing hard enough and that fire can jump miles and miles of burned over area. So, yes, some fire departments are beginning to think about how to contain ground fires. We need lots more training and lots more units dedicated to that. But in the end, there's simply no way really to contain a fire that has a strong wind behind it and has grown sufficiently strong.
Right.
There's a, to paraphrase that, that old song, there's a time to know when to fight and when to run. And
yes,
some of these fires.
That's part of the training is if you don't do it in a wind. So at the moment, the job is left mainly to conservation people. And we would wish that the fire departments would be right in there creating the preventative measure at the appropriate ecological time when they know how much litter is on the ground and what the wind is and what the constraints are and what equipment that they need to be there to contain it. You don't have to have a 200-foot prairie fire. You can have a 3-foot prairie fire if you know how to do it.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I mean, even laws for simply for to clean up litter. To clean up, I mean, ground cuttings, cut grass so that it's a certain level to get rid of litter and so on. But so many municipalities and so many counties in these days are so short of funds that when they finished funding education and funding the sewer system and paying for whatever, then that those essential prevention measures get pushed to the bottom of the budget, and you don't have the brush cleaned up, and you don't have the grass cut, and you don't have the fire inspections, and you're absolutely right. Then you do leave yourself, particularly with the way the world is warming and drying. You leave yourself in a very, very dangerous spot.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to thank the caller, and I want to give you, Professor Hoffer, just a chance now to round out our conversation to talk just a little bit about 9/11. And as I said at the beginning of the program, I think what you're suggesting with the book is that people set aside the cause just for a moment and to think about the what happened there for what it was, that is, a high-rise fire, two high-rise fires, the like of which we've never seen before.
Well, the reason why I included in the book on city fire is that the World Trade Center complex is kind of a city within a city. At sort of at maximum capacity, there could be 55, 60,000 people working in that complex of seven buildings. Fortunately or unfortunately, the attacks came at a time when the two towers were not fully occupied. So we didn't have the casualties that we might have had or perhaps that the terrorists hoped for. The other thing is that although it was fires that brought those buildings down, the point that I make in the book is that those buildings were not built with one eye or maybe two eyes on fire prevention. I mean, fire prevention would require, according to the old codes, codes that came out of the old 19th century, early 20th century fires, they would require concrete and fireproof tile reinforced core, which you didn't find in those buildings. They would require hardened fire exits, and those stairwells were not hardened. They would require for that building, for those two towers, at least, say, 9 rather than 3 exits, and the exits would be scattered around the building, not clumped together in the core where they could be destroyed by the impact of the airplanes. Those stairwells were so narrow that only two people could pass. You can see that in the pictures. Those of us who were one time or another up in that building knew how narrow those stairwells were. And what was the point of all of that? The point of all of that was that fire prevention, that making those buildings safe for people to escape them for any reason during a fire, took up otherwise rentable commercial space. And those buildings were designed to maximize rentable space, to make money. And who pays the cost? The cost is paid by the people who would be trying to escape a fire high in the building, and by the firefighters who would be going up those stairs to try to rescue people who'd be trapped.
Yeah.
Those are the people who pay the price for all of the cost-cutting, rent-maximizing, non-fireproofing decisions that were made in putting those buildings up.
Just to finish, and I'm sorry I can only give you about a minute to do it, but you defend now your subtitle and talk about the ways in which these fires not only reshaped their cities, but reshaped America.
Well, they teach us that cities do come back. They teach us that a valuable real estate, even if there's a devastating fire, will not only find a way to rebuild and repopulate, but also to find a way to improve itself. So the fires, which are in themselves terrible stories, are also stories of optimism and hope. And that is characteristically American.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Hoffer, for giving us some of your time talking about the book.
Thank you.
Our guest, Peter Hoffer, he is Distinguished Research Professor of History at University of Georgia and is the author of the book that we have been talking about. Again, the title is Seven Fires, The Urban Infernos That Reshaped America, and it is published by Public Affairs Books. The broadcast today made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Someone once said, love is blind, friendship closes its eyes. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, an exploration of friends and friendship with writer and editor Joseph Epstein. His latest book is Friendship and Exposé. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. She'll be welcoming your calls for Joe Epstein in the 1 o'clock hour of the program. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with news from NPR, the BBC, AM 580, and there'll also be an update on the weather and some other features as well. That's the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host, and it starts at noon. We're going to take a break here. When we continue with our program, we will talk with Philip Cooper. He's professor of public administration at Portland State University, and we'll talk about presidential signing statements, something that has been used now more and more by President Bush and has been somewhat controversial in regards to the expansion of presidential power. So more on that in the next hour, though right now, an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information on